Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 2006. Today's session is titled Stem Cells and Cloning, presented by Jan Chalupny. The number is CH-A 2006-4. Let's listen in.
Thanks. So I'm Jan Chalupny. I'm here at Holden teaching science. I'm a molecular biologist. I work at a biotech company called Amgen. And today we're going to talk about stem cells and cloning, a couple of topics that are in the news pretty frequently. But when you read little news blurbs, there's often not a whole lot of explanation about exactly what a stem cell is or what it can do or where it came from or how cloning is done. So a lot of times, if you don't work in science as your chosen field, there are a lot of details that are missing, and it's helpful to know a little more background to really understand what's being reported and to really be able to identify ethical issues related to those kind of stories. So we'll start with stem cells first and cloning second, because they're kind of related. So a stem cell has a couple of important characteristics that I wrote up there. They're unspecialized, or they're often called undifferentiated. So they're cells that have a lot of potential. They're cells that can, as it says in number two, they can be induced to become cells with specialized functions. So they're kind of an unspecialized cell, and they hang around in your body and renew themselves for quite a long period of time. So a lot of your cells, like your skin cells, they don't live forever. They migrate up to the top of your skin and die, and then that's your keratinized outer skin layer. Same with other cells in your body, but they have to get renewed from somewhere, right? Or all the cells in your body eventually died, and you only got one of every cell that you needed, you'd be in trouble. So there are cells in your body that have this function, that they're unspecialized, that they renew themselves over long periods of time, and under the appropriate, when they get the appropriate signals, they can differentiate, they can become specialized cells with special functions. And there are two types of stem cells. There are embryonic stem cells and there are adult stem cells. And embryonic stem cells, as the name implies, come from an embryo. Right, so there are a lot of ethical issues that come up with the development, the potential development and use of embryonic stem cells. So I'm just going to, this is a little handout that just diagrams what happens as far as stem cells in an embryo, how they develop. Because we have really a huge number of specialized tissues in our body. And it's pretty miraculous that when egg and sperm meet, they fuse and they become what's called the zygote, or the fertilized egg. And then this starts dividing, right? It divides, and there's two, and there's four, and there's eight, and there's 16. And eventually, after a number of cell divisions, usually about 5 to 10 days after fertilization, you get this thing that's called a blastocyst. And it's a hollow ball of cells that are all the same. They've all come from this single fertilized egg. They're all essentially stem cells. They haven't differentiated into specific tissues. There's 100 or so of the cells. And it's at this stage that this can be a source of stem cells. And so as you can see from the diagram that I passed around, the zygote develops into the blastocyst, and then as this develops further to another stage that's called the gastrula, you start to get the tissues, instead of all the cells being essentially identical, there are chemical signals that are still not fully understood that cause some of these cells to develop into ectoderm, some into mesoderm, some into endoderm, and some into your germ cells. Eggs if you're female, and sperm if you're male. And then these different types of tissue further continue to differentiate into yet more specialized tissue. So the ectoderm develops into skin cells, neurons in the brain, and pigment cells. The mesoderm further differentiates into a number of types of tissue, and the endoderm as well, until you have all the different types of tissue necessary to make a fully formed organism. So embryonic stem cells are a single type of cell that can develop into every single kind of tissue in the body. And it's an area that there's a lot of interest in for a number of reasons. You've probably read articles about why would people be interested in stem cells, a cell that can develop into any type of tissue in the body. Any ideas? Anybody read any?
Growing new body parts,
yeah.
Tissue replacements are different, like for neurological
Parkinson's disease, yeah.
So they can be used as a cure or to replace tissue or cells.
Right, replace damaged tissue, yeah. So that's one of the reasons that there's a lot of interest in this area. And people that do this type of research want to understand how exactly those undifferentiated cells in the blastocyst become all the different types of cells in the body. Because if they understand the kind of chemical signals that those cells need to see to become a heart muscle versus a neuron for the brain versus a bone cell, then they can kind of force those cells to become those types of tissue and use those tissues in therapies for people who have muscle degeneration or neural degeneration or bone loss. So that's a reason that there's interest. It's a potential use of stem cells. And embryonic stem cells carry a lot of ethical questions or ethical baggage, because you need to form the blastocyst. You need to have the sperm and egg meet in a test tube or a petri dish, have the egg become fertilized and develop into the blastocyst, and then use that as a source of cells. And depending on where you fall in with your feelings as far as where life begins, that can be ethically problematic. Is that blastocyst a person? Should it be given the status of a fully developed, should its status be the same as that of a fully developed fetus, for instance? I don't know if people have opinions on that. Is it something that has the potential for life, or is it a fetus under development? Is it okay to create blastocysts in the lab and use them to harvest stem cells from and do research on? Or is that the same as killing a potential human being? So that's a thorny issue, and there are varieties of stances that people take on that issue. But that's one of the hot buttons as far as stem cells are concerned.
Is there stem cells in umbilical cords?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are.
That's
in umbilical vein,
right.
Blood is used in transplants. Mm-hmm. It contains, so that's mostly for blood, the stem cells that form the blood cells to repopulate that. That is a source. So that's not exactly an embryonic stem cell.
Right,
but
I was just looking at it in terms of.
That would be more on the adult. So the second type of stem cells are adult stem cells. So within our own bodies, if the only source of stem cells was the embryo and then everything differentiated fully and became a fully formed organism, human or whatever other type of organism, then you'd be out of stem cells and you might be in trouble. But there are stem cell populations in various parts of our bodies that can develop into certain numbers of types of tissues. It's still kind of hotly contested whether there are any stem cells in our bodies that can be induced to develop into every kind of tissue, or whether you need to find. There are certainly stem cells within the bone marrow, and that's my other second handout. So this is a diagram of the bone marrow and the various types of cells. So stem cells in the bone marrow repopulate pretty much everything that's in your blood. So all the different types of white blood cells, which are part of the immune system, the T cells, the B cells, the neutrophils, the basophils, the natural killer cells, as well as the red blood cells. So that's a source, and that's where the cord blood comes in. Those are stem cells that can repopulate. So they're mostly used for bone marrow transplant for people that have leukemia, for instance, to repopulate the bone marrow with healthy cells. Once you've killed off all the, hopefully killed off all the cancerous cells with chemotherapy. So if we understood better what types of stem cells there were in the adult, and were able to get those to differentiate into different types of tissue, we could, to a certain extent, perhaps get away from the embryonic stem cell ethical conundrums. I don't think people would find it nearly as ethically problematic to take stem cells from an adult person who can give informed consent, and where there's no, it has the potential to develop into a fetus. So that's that would solve some of those problems.
So one quick question is, mm-hmm. is stem cells from other animals, because clearly as a society we don't have the same issues with other animals, obviously we put human life on a higher plane. But stem cells from others, right off the bat, they're so genetically different that they're of no use to us, basically.
Right. They're of use as far as being used in research for other purposes to understand how cells differentiate. So, for instance, mice are used a lot in scientific research. They can be bred easily, and they reproduce fairly quickly. And they're fairly close to us. They're other mammals. Our DNA is quite similar to theirs. They have a lot of homologous genes to what we have. You know, a lot of the genes that are working in our cells are, mouse has their version of that gene too. So there's a lot of stem cell work being done in mice to try and better understand how stem cells work in general, because a mouse is an easier organism to work with than a human. But as far as using those stem cells for any human therapy, that would not be possible because of our immune system, which is its main function is to determine self from non-self, to discriminate self from non-self. So if it sees bacteria or virus or whatever, it calls in other cells of the immune system to attack that and get rid of it, and that's what it would do with the cell from another organism. It would look at that cell, the immune cells look for certain molecules, certain proteins on the surface of cells, and if those aren't there, then the assumption of that cell is that that's not self, and that cell is eliminated. So using those for therapy wouldn't be possible, but certainly they're being studied because it's easier to study cells of other animals than it is to get a whole bunch of stem cells from humans. And you're right, there aren't the same ethical issues. If you make a bunch of mouse blastocysts, there are different ethical issues. There are many people who are completely opposed to animal research. But it's a higher plane when you're talking about human blastocysts versus mouse blastocysts. There are still challenges, of course. We don't completely understand what signals turn specific genes on and off, and that's what has to happen for a stem cell to differentiate into more specialized kinds of tissue. But that's why there's a lot of interest in this area and continuing research in this area. There are some other things that stem cells could be used for, aside from learning more about development and being able to grow tissue in the lab for transplant, for instance. You could also test new drugs. If you knew how stem cells worked and how to get them to differentiate into different types of tissue, you could perhaps test a new drug that you want to use on the nervous system or in muscle cells or skin on tissue that's been grown in the lab instead of having to test on animals before going into humans. So at the present, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, requires by law that companies that are coming up with new therapeutics test those therapeutics in animals before they go into humans. So that's the law. We have to, and mice are usually the animal of choice. And sometimes higher mammals like other primates, which is even more disturbing to many people than experimentation on mice. And so perhaps if you could grow actual human tissue in the lab, in a dish, you could test these drugs on that tissue rather than testing, doing as much testing in other whole organism systems. So that's what stem cells are and the types of stem cells and what they might be used for if we knew enough to really use them in therapies, which no one has truly discovered how to differentiate all the different types of tissue from a stem cell, but that's one of the reasons that people get upset when the government wants to restrict that type of research. It's one of those things where there's two sides to the issue. You don't want to be doing things that are unethical, but if you completely restrict the research, then people suffering from grievous illness that might be helped by this type of research, like people with Parkinson's, for instance, muscular dystrophy, things like that, they're upset, as are other scientists and other people, that you're sort of halting the progress of knowledge that might result in treatments for these folks. So it's a difficult issue, and it's hard to know where exactly the line should be drawn, or if there should be a line, or if there should be a gray area, and it should be taken on a case-by-case basis. But legally, there aren't a whole lot of rules. There are rules. There are laws against human cloning. But stem cells are not quite to that point. Although, when we get into the cloning question, you'll see that the two are kind of related to each other. So as far as cloning goes, a clone is essentially an exact genetic copy of something. So there are various types of clones. There's a cloned gene, so that's an exact copy of the DNA of a certain gene, and that's been done for years. And there are a lot of treatments like insulin. People who have diabetes, insulin used to have to be purified from pig pancreas. But once the gene was cloned, then you could put that gene into bacteria and grow a ton of bacteria, and they pump out the insulin, human insulin. So they're used kind of as a drug factory, kind of a human insulin factory. So you can, bacteria divide very, very quickly. So you can grow a ton of bacteria in a very short time. And if they're all pumping out insulin, then you can purify that human insulin from the solution that they're living in and use that. And that's what's used now, purified. It's called recombinant human insulin. And that's probably better for people to get human insulin rather than porcine insulin from a pig. So there are a lot of clone genes that have gone on to be used to isolate the human form of the protein that can be used as a drug or therapy.
When has that become commonplace? For example, the insulin, is that something that's happened in the last 10 years, 20 years ago, that the cloning allowed that to happen?
In the last decade or two, yeah. It's become much more common. The first biotech companies started springing up, many of them around this ability where they've cloned a gene and they could now make that recombinant protein. That was the early 80s, Genentech, places like that. That was kind of the birth of molecular biology or biotechnology. So it's just within the last couple decades. You can also have a cloned cell line. So if you have a cell and you give it whatever it needs, whatever nutrients it needs, and it divides and divides and divides and it divides, that population of cells is a clonal population. They all came from one cell. They all have the exact same DNA within the nucleus. And that's...
Yeah.
is if you take a stem cell, can you induce it to differentiate into another type of cell?
It has the potential for that, yeah, if you know what to give it.
So
what kind of stimuli, what kind of nutrients.
And once you've done that, and that has been done, right?
Well, people are working on that.
Okay.
I don't think there are many instances where they've successfully gotten, especially an embryonic stem cell, to develop all the way into some specialized kind of tissue.
And what about, like, with the blood that you were, when you were talking about?
Adult stem cells?
Yeah, and
they can separate stem cells from the blood,
okay,
from the bone marrow, and use those in transplants. But they're not getting it to differentiate into the different parts. They're putting it into someone else's body where it goes. They put that into the bone marrow, and then the cells know what to do. The bone marrow's their normal environment. They get all the right stimuli, and they develop on their own. They differentiate on their own.
So that technology or that isn't happening in a lab right now, that they're able to take those and...
No, that's the hope for the future, essentially. So cloned cell lines have been around for a very long time, 20, 30, maybe even 40 years. A lot of those cell lines are cancer cell lines that are isolated from patients, because cancer is sort of cell growth out of control. And those cells don't need as many different types of nutrients, so they're easier to grow in culture. So while they're really bad for the person that has them, they're helpful in the lab because you can grow them more easily and you can learn a lot of things from them. If you isolate what's called primary cells from yourself or some other person, so if you've got a clone cell line, a clone T cell line, say, which is a type of white blood cell, that thing grows great in culture. We already know most of the nutrients that it needs, and we can grow them. They divide every 24 hours. You can grow tons of cells. You can do all sorts of experiments with them. If you take blood from a person, you can isolate the white blood cells out of there, but they won't survive very long in culture because we just don't know all the different types of stimuli that they need to keep growing and dividing. So they only survive a few days in culture. So cell lines are very useful for research, because you can grow them and grow them and grow them and do a lot of different types of experiments where you need large numbers of cells. Although you have to always remember that whatever you discover in a cancer cell line might not be exactly the same in a primary cell that's not transformed, that doesn't have the out-of-control growth. But it is a tool, and you can learn a lot.
So you'd use something like that to test new drugs then?
Or just... figure out how T cells act, how different proteins on the cell work, those kind of things. You could potentially test drugs on those kind of cells in culture. But there are a lot of different types of cells that we don't have cell lines for, good cell lines. So blood cells, especially white blood cells, there are tons of cell lines from all different types of cancers from all different patients. But there are a lot of other types of cell lines that we don't have good ones for. And if you really want to test a drug, if you want to test a cancer drug, transformed cell line is great. But if you want to test a drug for some kind of tissue that's not cancerous, cancer cell line might not be the best choice. So they certainly are used for testing a number of types of drugs. And then the type of cloning that gets people upset the most is whole organism cloning, where you're trying to make an identical copy of another organism. And whole organism clones exist already, sort of naturally, identical twins. Identical twins are clones of each other. They have the exact same genetic material. They're essentially, the sperm has met the egg, the zygote has formed, it divides into two. And then instead of having those two cells remain together and divide into 4 and 8 and 16 and finally form the blastocyst, they split apart and then they begin dividing again and each form their own blastocyst. And two fetuses develop in the same womb that are genetically identical. Fraternal twins are two different sperm meet two different eggs and you get two fetuses, but they're not genetically identical. So there are clones walking the earth right this moment, But they're not exactly the same, right? I mean, genetically they're identical, but we probably all of us have met twins at some point in our lives, and they certainly don't have the same personalities, right? They're completely different people. So genes, our genetic makeup isn't the only thing that makes us the unique individual that we are. It has a lot to do with it, as to, you know, it determines our hair color and our eye color and the shape of our face, and weighs in on a lot of different things, like how tall we grow, although our environment determines that as well. Do we get good nutrition or not? So it's not all in the genes. Your environment has a lot to do with who you are, who you become. Studies of twins show that there is a genetic component to personality and likes and dislikes. There are a lot of studies that have looked at identical twins that were put up for adoption, and they were each adopted to a different family, and so they grew up not knowing each other at all. And then, for the purposes of this study, they're reunited, and they discover that they have chosen very similar professions, or they both love horseback riding, and they find the same things funny, those kind of things. So there's a genetic component for sure, but even identical twins that grow up in the same household for their whole lives have different personalities. So it's not all the nature versus nurture thing. You know, both things are important. Both things play a role. So for whole organism cloning, well, there are two types of whole organism cloning, and this is where we get to kind of how cloning is related to the stem cell procedure. There's therapeutic cloning, and that is to generate stem cells. That's the purpose of that type of cloning. It's not to grow a fully formed individual of whatever species is being cloned. It's purely to generate the stem cells. So sperm meets egg in a petri dish, zygote results, grown to the blastocyst stage, and then used as a source of stem cells. If you want something that's an exact genetic copy, there's a slightly different procedure that happens, and it's diagrammed on this handout. And there are already a number of animals that have been cloned. So reproductive cloning, the purpose of that is to obtain a fully formed organism that comes to term and is born. That's a genetic copy of another individual. And so that has to be done a different way. You can't, when sperm meets egg, the genetic material from each parent mixes. You get one gene, you have two copies of every gene, you have two sets of chromosomes, and you get one from your mother and one from your father. So if you're looking to create a genetically identical, an organism that's genetically identical to one other organism, even if you take an egg from that organism and it meets sperm from some other individual, it's not going to be a genetic clone. So as is diagrammed on that sheet that's going around, you take a cell from the individual that you want to make a clone from, and you take the nucleus out of that cell, then you take an egg, and you remove the nucleus from that egg, and put the nucleus from the cell, from the individual you want to clone, into that egg. So it's a very, it's not how it happens in real life, right? So you're sucking the nucleus out of this egg, and you're sucking the nucleus out of this other cell, that's an adult cell, because you need, an egg only has one set of chromosomes, and the sperm has another set, and when they fuse, then you get the two sets that are necessary to develop a fully formed organism. So that's, you remove that egg nucleus, and you take a nucleus from a non-sex cell, from whatever individual you want to clone. So it could be a skin cell, any kind of cell that's not a sperm or an egg. So a cell that has the complete set of chromosomes, 23 times 2. So you suck that nucleus out, you suck the nucleus out of the egg, you stick the nucleus in from the organism you want to clone, Then you have to zap the egg a little bit with some electricity to kind of stimulate it to get it to start to divide. And then it divides and divides and divides and becomes a blastocyst. And those are implanted in a pseudo-pregnant female, a female that's undergone some hormone treatment to make its body think that it's pregnant so that this thing will implant.
You mentioned yesterday that mitochondria have their own genetic material.
They do, yeah.
Does that, does the cell that you take the nucleus out of have mitochondria at that point? Or if so, does that...
So that's a good question. So all the mitochondria are going to come from the egg. So, right, it's kind of funky that way. It's not completely genetically identical to where it came from because you haven't transferred the mitochondria from the cell that you're using to clone, only the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, and that's also why you get all your mitochondria from your mother. Because when the sperm fuses with the egg, only the nucleus of the sperm is extruded into the egg with very little of the cytoplasm. And the egg has a gazillion mitochondria. And so they're all from your mother. You can trace maternal lineage by looking at mitochondrial DNA. But the mitochondria has very few genes. It doesn't have the giant genome that your nucleus has. It just has genes that are involved in energy production because the mitochondria is kind of the energy producer of the cell. But that's a good question. So the mitochondrial DNA in the cloned individual is not from the cell that the nucleus is from. So they're an exact genetic copy of nuclear DNA, but not of mitochondrial DNA.
So then can you make a clone of a man?
Yes, you can, yeah. You take a skin cell, because the X and Y chromosome are in the nucleus. So it would even a male that develops from kind of normal biological fertilization where sperm meets egg inside the woman still gets all his mitochondria from his mother. What you need for male versus female is XX chromosome versus XY chromosome, and those are in the nucleus. So you can make a clone from a male cell, and it will develop into a male individual. So the difference between therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning is that instead of taking that blastocyst and kind of shooting all the cells apart and studying them and how they develop into other tissues just using the stem cells, you implant those into a pseudo-pregnant female and allow that to grow to term. And then you've got a genetically identical at the nuclear level organism that's genetically identical at the nuclear level to whatever organism, whatever individual you took that cell from. So that's been done for a number of types of animals already. Dolly the sheep was the first one that made big headlines, which you may have seen. That was the first cloned organism. Then now done cows, mouse, pig, mule, cat, monkey, rabbit, guar. Guar is like this endangered kind of antelope type animal. That they cloned and implanted into a, I can't remember if it was a goat or a cow. So one of the things cloning can be used for is to, for endangered species. So if you're getting, your population's getting way down, of cheetahs or whatever, you can clone the cheetahs to keep them alive, to keep from losing the species.
Weren't there some problems with those clones, someone like the sheep?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going next. So the whole cloning process is fraught with problems because you know you stick a needle into the cell, this tiny, tiny needle, and suck out the nucleus, right? So are you damaging anything else while you're in there? Maybe, maybe not. And then you suck the nucleus out of the egg cell, and then you squirt the nucleus from the other cell into the egg cell, and then you zap it with electricity.
So suck, squirt, and zap.
And so at all of those points, since we don't fully understand everything that happens when sperm and egg fuse and the zygote is formed and then goes on to develop into a fully formed organism, since we don't understand all those things, we also can't completely, we don't completely know that we're not messing up a few things in there while we're doing all these manipulations. And the success rate of getting fully formed organisms from cloning is fairly low. A lot of the blastocysts don't implant, a lot of them don't develop. So it's a low success rate, lower than in vitro fertilization where you've got sperm and egg meeting in a dish and then forming a blastocyst and being implanted. And that's 50% or lower. You know, it's gotten a lot better in the past few decades than it was at first. And cloning is lower still. And as well, a lot of the organisms that do come to term and look normal, you know, from the outside when you just look at them with your eye, so that would be what's called phenotypically normal. The cow's got four legs and they're the right size and it's got two ears and it looks like a cow. Sometimes on the inside there are problems. So Dolly developed arthritis early for a sheep. And she died early as well. She did not live as long as the average sheep. And a number of other animals, I know in the case of cows, at least one of them had severe immunological problems. So we can do it. I mean, it can be done, but it's not completely understood what exactly is happening at every stage, and is anything getting a little messed up as nuclei are sucked out and squirted in and cells are stimulated to divide.
But it seems though that you also wouldn't know, for example, with Dolly the sheep, if she developed arthritis and died early, you know, it's like people develop diseases
right.
and stuff, so then
you
really
you have to have a larger population of cloned animals to be able to say, on average. And I think that kind of data has been generated at this point. There have been a larger number of animals cloned, and it is clear that they have defects with a higher frequency than animals that result from natural births. But you're right, on the basis of one, you go like, okay, well, was that because she was cloned? Or was that just because she developed arthritis early from other causes? You don't really know for sure until you have a larger population and you can say something statistically about the frequency of abnormalities.
And don't you think, I mean, this research is just at the cutting edge, and if you look at like the beginning of computers, the monstrosities that computers were, and the whole technological changes, you know, what now is squish squat is going to be fine-tuned and in the future, and you know, once a breakthrough is made, it can go so much more quickly. I mean, don't you think that?
That's true.
I mean,
certainly
we're just at the.
The more
where it's so
people work on it, and the
yeah.
more that is learned about what's going on, the better the technique can become.
Right.
I
and
guess
different technique.
One of the questions is, should it be done at all? So, you know, what's the purpose for cloning an organism? Why would somebody, you know, what would be the benefit?
Well, I guess I'd ask, what would be the purpose of researching cancer cures? Or, you know, I mean, I think sometimes we don't even know the answer yet. Because
illness.
Right.
If you're looking at the cures for cancer. But to clone a sheep, you know, why? What's the purpose of cloning a sheep?
Because you really love that sheep.
Or maybe that sheep has the most awesome wool ever and produces tons of it, and so you want a whole flock of sheep that do that. But what would be the drawback of a flock of sheep that are all genetically identical?
Well, they'd be extremely susceptible to the same if there were one virus or disease.
Right, so genetic diversity is an important thing, and that's what keeps species alive. Some plague comes through or disease, if there's genetic diversity within a population, there's going to be a range of susceptibility or resistance in that population, and some of the members of that population will die, but some will survive. But if you have a genetically identical population, then that's going to be much more of a problem or a risk. And I think that's been demonstrated with agriculture. Mm-hmm. You know, if you breed the Wonder Potato that grows really fast and you can get way more of them and you can sell them and make a lot of money, but they're all exactly the same and the potato blight comes along, they may all die.
Like, I'm reading this book right now about corn.
Corn,
that,
anything that we grow agriculturally, we tend to try and pick what's considered the best for what we want. Grows fast, makes a lot of ears, etc. But it's not always the greatest thing to have a very genetically homogeneous crop.
It seems like that's something we sort of fight as a, as this, that mankind fights, is this idea. I mean, we see it all the way through our society, of this idea of finding the perfect thing. And it seems like just now we're waking up to the fact that that diversity is always better. Diversity in a city is better.
Mm-hmm.
A diversity of populations, a diversity of uses. And it's contrary to what we were doing in the 60s, which was spreading things. It seems like that's sort of the nature of mankind, is to want to find the perfect thing and to separate it and to isolate it. And you do that and you lose diversity, but it seems like right now we're getting this pushback of realizing that diversity is better.
And there are, on the plant side of it, there are institutes or groups that try to keep seed stock or whatever, say heirloom potatoes. There's a gazillion varieties of potatoes in the world, and we mostly only see 3 or 4 or 5 of them that show up in the grocery store. But there are tons and tons of kinds of potatoes, same thing with corn, all different types of crop plants. So there is a recognition that it's important to keep that diversity around, and to not, because that's, it's the same as extinction almost. If you completely lose all the seed stock, that's kind of your genetic stock for that type of plant.
For example, with corn, farmers don't have to keep their own seed. Someone else produces a seed for them, so the ground lays without having to plant. They don't have to put nitrogen back into it because they can just buy this already perfect seed, and they don't collect their own seed anymore at all, which is a huge question about bioengineered or,
who gets to decide what the best characteristics are,
right,
too? That's kind of a power question. Who decides what's good, what things we should select for genetically, and what things we should select against? It's not as ethically charged in the case of plants as it is in the case of humans, for instance.
I'm very passionate about my corn species, so.
Hmm?
I'm very passionate about corn species, so.
Okay. I'm not saying that there might not be some people that feel strongly about plant species. It's probably good that there are.
But one point. Don't you think sometimes that we can get so caught up in that whole area of, okay, cloning a whole person, that we get that whole controversy, and do we really want to do that? But we get caught up in that, and then lose sight of what can be done with cloning stem cells.
That's a large part of the debate.
Right.
When George Bush came out against human cloning, and there is a law against, well, the federal government does not support any research institute that does certain types of research. And there's a moratorium on developing new stem cell lines. They can use the ones that were already developed, but not develop new ones. Okay, so then recently, scientists in Korea reported that they had successfully isolated human stem cells. And later on, one of the scientists sort of had to recant and say there was some fraud in the reporting of those results. But what got a lot of people hot and bothered here on the pro-research side is, hey, you know, other countries are doing this. We're falling behind in this research. We're not learning enough about how to generate stem cells and then how to stimulate them to become specialized, differentiated cells that could be used for research purposes. So that's part of the debate.
Mm-hmm. There's a species of tortoise. There's one left in the wild. In general, actually, could you clone that to make the population bigger, or would it just stay and become extinct eventually?
You could conceivably clone the tortoise. You wouldn't be able to use if the tortoise is female, you could use the tortoise's own egg and a cell from the tortoise and put the nucleus that has the full complement of chromosomes into the egg cell and take out the egg's nucleus. If the tortoise is male, you'd have to find some genetically related species, a very related species of tortoise, to get the egg from. So you could clone that tortoise conceivably, but then the population that you grow up is going to be very genetically identical.
It'll be all male or all female, right? Depending on what theory.
Also true, yeah.
Oh.
If you don't have a one of each, yeah, then
you have to catch them before there's only one.
Right.
But then it's kind of doomed to be extinct anyway.
You just keep on cloning it, and that brings up other ethical issues around how should resources then be spent? Should they be spent on cloning the endangered animal, or should they be spent on habitat restoration or habitat protection so that those animals can stay alive on their own? Because that's usually the reason that a species becomes extinct, because of some sort of thing involving humans, either killing them all, like the passenger pigeon, or encroaching in their habitat so much that they no longer have enough room to live and reproduce. Okay, just to talk more on the human cloning side of it, where there are the most ethical issues, can anyone think of any reasonable or viable reason why you would want to clone a human? Is there any reason that's compelling enough to warrant cloning a human?
Well, hasn't there been an issue of a sick, gravely sick child, and who can only be cured with similar cells?
Right, but that wouldn't be cloning the whole human. That would be maybe creating stem cells from that sick child that can develop into healthy cells of whatever type that that sick child needs that can be used to treat that sick child.
But couldn't you do that? Oh, my kid does. Forget for crude example because it's filled with holes. But oh, my kid has a liver problem, and I desperately want to find a solution. I will grow a new little kid so that I can harvest his liver to save my living kid.
Yeah, that's. There you wouldn't necessarily need a clone, you just need genetically matched. And that's something that we discussed yesterday in my session yesterday where we were talking about genetic selection. Mm-hmm. That's actually already been done by people who have gravely ill children and who've had in vitro fertilization done. And then you can take a few cells from that blastocyst and look at the DNA and do DNA sequencing and find out if that blastocyst could grow into a genetically matched person, and then implant those into the mom, so you get another child. It's not a clone because it's made from sperm and egg from mom and dad.
But they're genetically matched.
But that you've screened at the blastocyst level for blastocysts that are genetically matched to the sick child. Yeah, that's been done. Kid's been born, cord blood used. As a treatment for the sick child. Sick child still alive 6 years later. Apparently cured.
In that instance, though, I was going to say, yeah, so they have a young,
they're not a clone.
The kid is not disposable that they just had, though.
No,
because
right.
The technology's not there to take those cells and do something with them, right? To take the cells from the blastocyst and differentiate them outside of
being
a person, that technology's not there right now. So
right. I mean, you can
the blastocyst has to be implanted so that the child can develop.
In the more stem cell situation, if more was known, you could potentially take the stem cells, those cells from the blastocyst, get them to differentiate into a liver or liver cells that are healthy and implant those back into the sick child. Have you just killed a potential life to make that liver? Or is it better to allow it to come to term and then take a piece of the liver to transplant? Can small children give informed consent? Is it ethical to take things from them sort of without asking because they are not able to understand if you can we have a piece of your liver? What does that mean to a kid? So is that ethical to... Sure, I hate liver. You can have all the liver you want right off my plate. Oh, you mean mine?
Because that can put them at risk going through surgery.
Yes, absolutely. And a book that we discussed in yesterday's session called My Sister's Keeper is about a situation where... it's a fictional situation, but as I mentioned, these kind of things have already happened, where there's a very sick child and the parents choose to conceive another child, screen it at the blastocyst level for genetic match, child is born, cord blood's used, puts the sick child in remission, but not permanently. And so then other things are harvested from the child, different types of white blood cells, granulocytes, bone marrow, in an attempt to cure the sick child. And it finally gets to the stage where the sick child's liver's kidney is failing, and they're going to die, and they need a kidney from this other child. And by this time, the other child's 13, and she sues for medical emancipation to be able to make the choice herself and not have it made for her. So it's a really good book. It's written from all the different points of view, the mother, the father, the different siblings in the family, the lawyer, the guardian. There are several copies in the bookstore.
One point, the only thing I can think of for cloning a human, or for research in cloning a human being is, you know, in the last 100 years, if you look at where technology has gone and questions that we wouldn't have known to ask 100 years ago, 20 years from now, we might have a whole lot of things that might depend on being able to clone another human being that we have no concept of right now, you know, the way technology moves. So I don't know that to stop research on that. I mean, I think that's a research that it's part of the whole, I mean, it's part of the whole research.
Well,
that's
almost
going
a separate question, though, whether to stop research on stem cells or whether it's okay to actually clone a human person. One question that you would have is, who are the parents of that clone? If I clone someone from one of my cells, who are the parents of that clone? Are they my parents? Are they my parents? I mean, genetically, they would be my parents. My parents would be that clone's parents. But if my parents aren't around anymore, then who parents that clone? What kind of parentage does that individual have?
Oh, then we'll have to redefine parenthood the same
and,
way
right.
we're trying
who
to
would,
redefine what a family
who would their family
is.
Be, exactly.
Is, which is being done all the time anyway.
Yeah, families change.
Yeah.
Big time.
But is it fair to bring an individual into a situation like that where all those things are cloudier than they are sort of under regular biological conditions?
A teenage pregnancy.
What are the expectations of that clone? So, I want to live forever or something, and I take one of my cells and make a clone of me. That person's not going to, I mean, as we've seen from, as is obvious from identical twins, that person's not going to grow up to be exactly like me. They may look like me, but they're going to have a completely their own personality. They're going to be an individual. And so if I'm trying to somehow prolong my life through them, what kind of expectations is that put in? Is it okay to put those kind of expectations? You know, or if my father just died and I can't bear that thought that he's gone and I want him to live on and I take one of his cells.
Then you're just uninformed, though, because we know that about twins. You know, someone has to be able
right,
to,
I know, but
know.
Is that, if you have those expectations of this developing child, is
a lot of parents have that expectation already.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
I'm living through my child. You know, I think that's a mental, that's more of a problematic with the mental health of the person. You know, that.
True. Parents often have, often want to live vicariously through their children.
That's because you know twins are different.
But sort of to a different level if you have made on purpose an exact genetic replica of you. Is human cloning a loving thing to do? Is it a loving thing to do to that individual that you're bringing into the world? Or are you doing it for reasons that are very much about what you want? And again, you can argue that about having biological children, that sometimes people have kids for reasons that are not well thought out, or for reasons that are more to do about things that they want than nurturing an individual human. Well, a number of denominations, faith groups have put out papers saying what they feel about these kind of things. The Catholic Church is very vocal against stem cell research and against cloning. And the Lutheran Church also has a publication called Human Cloning, Papers from a Church Consultation. And if anyone's interested in reading this, it can be obtained from the ELCA, from the Division for Church and Society. So,
is the Catholic Church against adult stem cell research? Or just...
I would guess not. Usually whenever anybody's vociferously denouncing stem cell research, it's embryonic stem cell research. Yeah,
but that's kind of clouded in the discussion, so.
Right. Well, that's
And when you say if someone, they don't necessarily say that they come out they're
against
all
stem cells. Exactly, and that's why I think it's important to understand that there are two different types, one fraught with far more ethical problems and issues than the other. I just wanted to read just a blurb from, so this human cloning thing, it's a number of articles, both by theologians and people in the medical community. And this blurb is from someone named Hans Teufel, who's a theologian, and his chapter is called In Our Image, Procreative Cloning and Faith. So he says, "My conclusion is that we should oppose human cloning on moral grounds. Such begetting gives too much control to the begetters over the begotten. Thereby, cloning deprives the child of too much. Two parents and two lineages and a unique start in life is not overshadowed by an existing physical identity carefully chosen and already designated with an identity and human image. Such a lot in life is too heavy, constraining, and cruel for any child. By contrast, the image to which biblical believers testify and to which the child should aspire offers a choice rather than a fate. And while the divine image also imposes a burden, that weight is light, freely born, and genuinely loving." So that's just an opinion of the many opinions in this set of papers. In general, I mean, I don't think any of the people in there come out and say, yeah, we should clone humans routinely. They're all more, no, that's not really good. You know, there are identical twins, but those arise without the control of the parent, without them.
But they also solve a lot of those issues because they are of two parents. And the other thing that I've heard, you know, like the example, you're not building an organism with sort of old DNA, which is what I've heard is one of the big issues with the cloning, which is I don't know enough scientifically to say it, but articulate it properly, but I remember one of the things I've read about when they did autopsies and analysis on Dolly and other clones is that, well, it was so, you know, that they can somehow date the DNA, and the DNA
was a good
consecutive
point.
Age. It wasn't new.
That's a very
DNA.
Good point, and I should make a note in future times when I teach this to mention that. There are things called telomeres that are at the end of the chromosomes, and every time the chromosomes divide, the telomeres get a little shorter, and it's believed that that has a lot to do with the aging process. So you're right. If you take the nucleus out of a cell that's already fully differentiated and that's been around for a while and undergone some cell divisions, that's quote-unquote older DNA than the DNA in either a sperm or an egg that has kind of the full component, the fully brand-new telomere, so to speak. So that is an issue as well, that is that part of the problem with clones, that they have this DNA that's aged at the start and then ages further. It's aging sort of at a faster rate because it started at a more fully aged position.
Does this ELCA report address embryonic stem cell research, or is that a separate book that they have?
It does address some of the stem cell.
Okay.
They don't have a separate book on stem cell research, and there is some discussion of stem cells in here. Another interesting ELCA publication is Genetics, Where Do We Stand as Christians? This can also be obtained. If you go to www.elca.org and you search on genetics, this will come up. If you search on cloning, this will come up. And you can get one free copy from the ELCA if you call them or email them. If you want lots of copies, then you need to buy them from, I think you get them from Oxford Fortress. But this has a little primer in genetics at the beginning, talk about DNA, genes, etc. And then genetic testing, genes and human behavior, gene patenting, genetically modified organisms, genetics, Christians, and the public debate. So it's kind of a useful. You can also, this one you can download off your computer, whatever chapters you want, or the whole thing. So those are some, if you're interested in what the Lutheran, the ELCA has to say about these issues. There's also an ELCA publication that's solely on genetic testing. And there's a copy or two of that in the bookstore, but that can also be obtained from the ELCA.
You know, the other, this isn't related, but I think it's a little related. In like some of the countries where, you know, being a female girl is not such a hot thing, and like China and India, even I think in Japan, there's some of that going on where they're, you know, they're able to find out really early whether it's a boy or a girl, and then there's a lot of, then they're aborting a lot of the girls,
mm-hmm.
hoping
yeah,
to get a boy.
Yeah,
you know, and you think of what that does to natural selection and the whole population.
Right, well, China's in trouble right now because there aren't enough women to marry the men that are of marrying age. And most of those female children were selected against far before there was genetic selection. It was just, I had a girl and I'm putting her in an orphanage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if you know people that have adopted babies of
right.
Chinese origin, I can't think of a single person I know that has adopted a Chinese baby that's adopted a boy baby.
No,
I do, but he had a...
It's just
a deformity
problem.
Yeah, they
tend to have
some, yeah.
some more challenges or defects.
Mm-hmm.
But as there's more and more research at a different level, you know, on a more complex level or the level that they can determine stuff a lot earlier, you kind of wonder where that's going to go.
Yeah, there was another little news story that we briefly discussed yesterday where a British couple who had four boys and one girl, their girl was tragically killed in an accident and they wanted another girl. And so they wanted to go the in vitro route and screen the blastocyst for gender and only implant potential female blastocysts. And there's a body in Britain that oversees these kind of things and they ruled against them. And they were appealing. I don't know where that's gone.
Is there, is there something like that here in this country?
No, there's not.
So people can just make
so,
those decisions.
Yeah, and, there was another article that we briefly discussed yesterday discussing the fact that there's some push in Britain now to screen embryos for various gene misspellings that predispose to cancer or other types of illness. And that actually happens already here because there is no oversight board, so nobody really knows how frequently it's done here to screen embryos that result from in vitro fertilization for the presence or absence of, because it's not selecting for or against the gene, it's whether the gene is misspelled or not.
So it seems obviously it's a highly charged issue, and so then you get the politics in the mix, and I'd just be interested to hear your perspective on the federal policy we have now. I mean, I have to believe it's fraught with well-intentioned misinformation, but.
Well, we don't have a lot of federal policy. I mean, we have the policy against human cloning,
mm-hmm.
and it bans stem cell research except on the populations of stem cells that have already been developed. That's pretty much the policy.
That's it.
Yeah. My father-in-law is a federal judge in the state of Indiana, and so I asked him this question because I don't know that much about the legal situation either, and he said basically the legal system lags far behind in these issues. Things sort of come up on one basis in court. Okay, so two individuals can't conceive because the female is sterile for one reason or another. So they take her eggs and his sperm, in vitro fertilization, implant embryos into her. But you always generate way more blastocysts than you actually use. So the rest get frozen in a freezer. So then, say those guys get divorced and she wants to have more children. But since she's the one that's unable to have children, she wants to use those blastocysts that are in the freezer. So that comes before the court when her ex-husband says, I don't want her to use those blastocysts in the freezer because I don't want to be a biological parent to any more kids. And even though she's remarried and the parent that would be raising those children would not be this guy, he would still be biologically connected to those kids. So things come up like that on a one-to-one basis, but there's not any regulatory body that really sets policy.
Where do people get the stem cells that they're doing research on now?
Some from early abortions, I mean really like spontaneous ones. Some where women have donated eggs and men have donated sperm and they make them in the bird. And they do in vitro fertilization in the lab and make stem cells. That's actually what happened. Part of the problem with the Korean case was that women in the lab had donated eggs and they weren't supposed to, because that's an ethical issue. Like, can you exert pressure on the people in your lab? You know, we need some eggs because we want to do this stem cell thing. So yeah.
And you got a bonus.
They needed eggs, and they knew they weren't supposed to donate, but they did it anyway and didn't tell the guy who was the head of the lab because they didn't want him to know and be blamed. But it all came out anyway, and that was part of the problem with that research.
But if someone in this country, let's say they store sperm or they store eggs for the future, and then they decide, okay, I've had enough kids, and there's still half a dozen in the freezer.
Yeah, you could conceivably give consent if you had blastocysts in the freezer. I don't know if women are ever asked that. Do you want to donate these blastocysts for research? And then that would be one source of stem cells.
And that would count as a stem cell line that already exists,
yeah,
so that
right.
would be fine to do research on.
Well, if it had already been developed into a stem cell line. I think the moratorium would say you can't take any more frozen blastocysts out of the freezer, because those could be put into a woman and potentially grow to term. So I think it's only the cell lines that are already completely established, yeah, that can presently be worked on.
Is there any legislation trying to reverse that decision, or is that?
Not that I know of. I mean, there's certainly pressure from the scientific establishment, and I don't know enough about, so those legal guidelines or rules, mm-hmm. how much they apply only to places that get federal funding versus what could go on
yeah.
in a private research group.
So anybody who's doing research has had to get permission from somebody who donated whatever?
Yeah. They're supposed to inform consent. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to have some kind of document that says, we asked this person if we could use their leftover blastocysts, or if we could use eggs or sperm for this type of purpose.
But if blastocysts are being stored and they can't develop new stem cells, wouldn't it be the same as ethical issue of using them versus discarding them altogether?
Yeah, exactly. So what, do they stay in the freezer forever? Once people have had several children, however many they wanted to, by in vitro fertilization, they probably don't necessarily desire to do anything with those blastocysts.
So isn't that kind of
so? Do you use them for research, or they throw away? They try and
keep them. Store them.
You probably can't store them forever in the freezer. I mean, you can store cells for a long time in a freezer and okay, but how long is the longest before you start to get breakdown of those cells?
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't be able to develop anyway. Yeah, those are all good questions.
And when you talk about breakdown, that's one of the things I'm curious about. If you have an existing stem cell line, isn't that breaking down too?
It can be. I don't think enough is known about stem cells, how long you can really grow them before they start to age and senesce and potentially die. And I'm sure as people are growing them, they're freezing down vials so that if the line started to senesce, they could go back to an earlier vial from
sure.
the freezer. But again, I don't know how long. I know I've pulled cells out of the freezer after 10 years and thawed them out, and they don't all survive, but enough of them survive. But that's a clone cell line. That's not stem cells. I mean, that's a more differentiated clone cell line.
Very interesting.
Thank you.